This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Summer Wives by Beatrice Williams, performed by Kristen Kelbley. Foreword, 1969. I returned to Winthrop Island on an unseasonably cold day in early May, 1 week after my 10th wedding anniversary. I missed the last ferry from New London. The schedule, not surprisingly, had changed in the 18 years since I last climbed aboard, and hired an old tub of a fishing boat to carry me across from Stonington. I don't think the fellow recognized me, but I can't be sure. Fishermen are a stoic lot, you know. They don't emote. I paid him $20 cash, and in return he didn't ask me any awkward questions, like my name and my business on the island, though I wonder if it would have made any difference. What was he going to do? Call the newspapers? Probably he'd never heard of me. Lots of people had never heard of me. Because it was May, the sky was still light as we bumped across the few miles of Long Island Sound that separate the island from Connecticut. I wore my sunglasses, which were black and extremely large, giving me the appearance of an exotic bug, and the spray soon coated the lenses with a film of salt. When I couldn't properly see any longer, I took them off. And the strength of the draft on my face surprised me, and the smell. I'd forgotten about the scent of the sound, which had its own particular tang, different from anywhere else in the world, the English Channel or the Mediterranean or the South Pacific. Or maybe it didn't, and that was all in my imagination. Still, it seemed to me as I stood near the bow of the fishing boat, leaning against the deckhouse, that the brine on that wind reached deep inside the wrinkles of my brain, penetrating the furthest regions of the hippocampus to lay its fingertip on certain tender memories therein. Bending over the stern of a lobster boat, hauling cages from a buoy line, sitting next to a girl at the end of a midnight dock, sharing a bottle of cold champagne. Lying on a beach while the rain coursed upon me and a boy, kissing each other for the last time. Ahead of me, the island made a dark, flattened parabola, growing larger by the second until it dominated the horizon, and the specks on its surface took on the character of houses. I saw the cluster of buildings around the harbor, the scattering of estates along the shore. I couldn't see Greyfriars from here, perched as it was on the southeastern corner of the island, but I knew it still existed, overlooking Fleet Rock and its famous lighthouse. I knew this because of the letter in my pocketbook, which was written on Greyfriars notepaper and signed, in old-fashioned reproachful copperplate, "Your Mother." There was no mention of Isabel, but I knew she existed too. There could be no Greyfriars without Isabel, could there? Without thinking, I turned to address the fisherman, and his face went rigid with shock at the sight of me, now unhidden by sunglasses. "An accident," I said, touching the bruised flesh around my left eye and my cheekbone. "An automobile accident." Remembering to use the American term, accident, instead of the British one, smash. "A car smash, which is an interesting difference, you know. To call it an accident implies an absence of intent. Nobody's fault. A tragic mistake. A smash is just that. Makes no judgment on how the thing happened or why."
"I'm sorry, ma'am." He returned his attention to the direction of the boat.
Like I said, a stoic lot. "These things happen," I said. "I was going to ask you a question, if you don't mind."
"Fire away."
"Do you happen to know who keeps the Fleet Rock Lighthouse these days? I used to summer on the island many years ago, and I was just wondering."
"The Fleet Rock Lighthouse? Why, that would be old Mrs. Vargas," said the fisherman, without changing expression, without turning his attention from the water before us.
"What about Mr. Vargas?"
"I'm afraid he's passed on, ma'am, just a few months ago. One winner too many, I guess."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"He was a good man, a good lobsterman."
I laughed politely. "Isn't that the same thing?" He laughed too.
"I guess it is, ma'am. I guess it is."
We said nothing more, all the way into the harbor, and I gave him another $5 to keep quiet about the woman with the black eye and the sunglasses who was asking questions about Fleet Rock Lighthouse. He put the Lincoln in his pocket and asked if he could help me with my suitcase. I said no. I was just heading into the general store across the street from the marina. He wouldn't take no for an answer, though, so I let him carry the suitcase anyway. Men sometimes like to make themselves useful that way, I found, and you might as well humor them. Inside the store, I absorbed the familiar, particular odor of dust and spices, and the scent gave me another jolt of exquisite pain to the solar plexus. There's something about the smells of your childhood, isn't there? Even when that childhood was short and flavored by bitterness and ended in catastrophe, in a disaster of devastating proportions, you still remember those small, sublime joys with an ache of longing. Because there's no getting it back, is there? You can't return to a state of innocence. So I waited patiently for the old woman behind the soda fountain to hustle and bustle her way around her shelves, her cabinets, her rows of merchandise, until at last she noticed my presence and apologized. "It's no trouble at all," I said. At the sound of my voice, her face changed, in much the same way as the fisherman's had. Her mouth made a perfect hole of surprise.
"Deus mio! Miranda Schuyler," she said in wonder.
"The prodigal returns." I removed my sunglasses.
"Oh, dear. What is this thing that has happened to your face?"
"There was an accident. A car accident. I thought I might find someplace quiet to lick my wounds. I hope you don't mind." Her voice was soft with pity.
"No, of course. Of course not." She paused delicately. "Do they know you are coming? At Greyfriars? Your mother? She was here yesterday, and she said nothing to me.
I thought I might surprise them. I don't suppose your husband still drives his delivery van, does he?"
"Oh, poor Manuelo. He is gone now."
"Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't think.
But I can drive you this far. My daughter Laura will keep the store for me. Laura! You remember Laura, don't you?"
"Naturally I remember Laura. I remember everybody and everything. How could I forget?" We exchanged a look of deep, futile understanding that lasted as long as it took for Mrs. Mediero's daughter, Miss Laura, scatter-haired and dumpy in a floral house dress, to emerge from some back room, clasp her hands, and express her absolute astonishment that the great Miranda Schuyler had returned to the island at last, that she stood right here in the middle of their humble store.
"Or must we call you Miranda Thomas?" she asked, pretending not to eye the shiner that disfigured the left side of my face.
"Just Miranda will do. I'm here unofficially, you understand."
"Ah, I see."
She smoothed her hair with one hand and looked at her mother, and some communication passed between them, to which Mrs. Mediero replied with a small shrug. Miss Laura picked up a dishcloth and put it down again. I was opening my mouth to speak when she burst out,
"What was it like to kiss Roger Moore?"
"Laura," snapped her mother. I slipped the sunglasses back over my eyes. "Just exactly as you might think," I said. We were halfway to Greyfriars before I asked Mrs. Mediero about her grandson, and she took her time to answer me.
"He's well," she said, "the last I heard."
He never did answer any of my letters. I wrote and wrote.
"He thought this was best. There was no hope, you see."
I set my elbow on the edge of the window, which was rolled down all the way to allow the May breeze inside the fish-smelling cab. I might have looked out toward the sea, which was darkening into a purple twilight, but I didn't. I knew what was out there, the cliffs dropping away into the water, and Fleet Rock like a dream against the horizon. Mrs. Mediero changed gears to thrust the old van up the slope.
"You have heard the news, yes?"
"That he escaped from prison?" "Yes, I heard."
"Is that..."
She bit herself off and rattled her thumbs against the steering wheel. "Is that why I've come back, you mean? Because of Joseph escaping from prison?"
"I'm sorry. It's your business why you're here."
It's a logical question. I don't blame you for asking. I mean, he's bolted from his prison, and now I've... Well, here I am, fresh from London. So you are here for him? I didn't say that. Oh, Mrs. Madeiro glanced at me. I just... Well, the police already came, the detectives, the marshals. I mean, they searched everywhere. They could not find him. I don't suppose you happen to know where he went? She shrugged. Who really knows about Joseph? He always keeps his own mind. That's not an answer, Mrs. Madeiro, I said. No, I guess not. I took off the sunglasses and folded them into my pocketbook. We had nearly reached the Greyfriars Drive, and my fingers were shaking, shaking. My heart was thundering. I had thought, after so many years, I should approach the house like an old friend with whom you had quarreled long ago, and since forgiven so far as to forget what the quarrel was about. But now I glimpsed the stone wall, crumbling to bits, and the gap through which I had walked so often, and the mighty, unkempt rhododendrons, and I was 18 again. Exactly half as old as my current age. Now there's symmetry for you. And knew nothing about keeping your emotions in check, your spirit under exquisite control. I gripped the handles of my pocketbook and counted the pulse of my breathing, as my husband had once trained me to do, yet still the flutter remained and worsened into dizziness. "Is everything okay, Miranda?" asked Mrs. Madeiro quietly. "Should I stop the car?" "No, thank you. Drive right on up to the door, if you don't mind." We turned down the drive and the tires crunched on the gravel, bounced over the ruts, dove into the potholes. In earlier days, the Greyfriars Drive was an impeccable thing, almost as smooth as asphalt, and Mrs. Madeiro, after one particularly bone-crunching jolt, was moved to apologize for the fall in standards, almost as if she had some responsibility for them. "Things aren't the same at Greyfriars, you know," she said. "I don't imagine they are. I think there is not much money now. You know they take in boarders." "Do they? I didn't know that. Mother never mentioned it in her letters." "She is proud. They don't call them boarders. It is, oh, what is it called? An artist colony." "Oh, of course. How lovely. Artists. A shame they aren't gardeners as well." We passed the last, the largest rhododendron of all, from which I kept my eyes carefully averted. The sun was gone now anyway, and everything had disappeared into shadow. Even Greyfriars, as it slid into view, was an anticlimax, just a long, dark shape containing a few specks of light. I found I was able to breathe again. Mrs. Madeiro pulled around the semicircle and brought the van to a rusty stop. "Should I wait?" she asked. "There's no need." I plucked my suitcase from the back and waved her away. She must have understood me, because she obeyed, and I waited until the headlights had disappeared around the corner of the rhododendron before I turned to stand before the front step. The light was off, or else the bulb was gone, and I couldn't see much. Just that the paint seemed to be peeling from that large front door, and I could no longer tell if it was black or green. Then it swung open. "My goodness, who?" Because of the light from the doorway, I couldn't see the face of the woman who stood before me. But I knew who it was. There could be no Greyfriars without her, after all. "Isabel," I said. "It's Miranda." June. 1930. Bianca Madeiro. 1. He is the most beautiful boy she's ever seen. More beautiful than Valentino or Errol Flynn or Lindbergh. She crosses herself when she sees him sailing his slim racing yacht up and down the Fleet Rock Channel with Peter Dumont, because of the danger, and because of the way the sun glints on his blonde hair, an effect so brilliant she observes it all the way from the little bluff at the top of West Cliff Road, where she goes to watch them in the afternoon. In her imagination, the sun is anointing Mr. Fisher as its own, and only the devil himself could plant such a blasphemous thought in her head. So she crosses herself. Today, Tia Maria needs her in the store, however, so there is no need for guarding oneself against the devil. The families have been arriving on Winthrop Island for the summer, one by one, by ferry and by private yacht, and so Bianca and her cousins must fill the shelves with the goods Tio Manuelo has ordered from the mainland. Canned peas and canned peaches and canned sardines in olive oil, saltine crackers and Campbell's tomato soup, Ivory soap and Clorox bleach, Ovaltine and Quaker oats and cornflakes, cantaloupe and pippin apples and bananas, Morton salt and Ceylon cinnamon, bags of flour and sugar and Calumet baking powder, Pond's cold cream and Listerine and aspirin, lots of aspirin, gardening gloves and razor blades, distilled white vinegar that is really vinegar, distilled white vinegar that is not really vinegar but kept on a shelf behind the wooden counter for particular customers, whom Tio Manuelo serves himself. The weather turned hot this week, the first week of June, and even though Tia Maria keeps the door wide open to usher in the salt breeze from the harbor, the atmosphere remains stuffy and smells of sawdust. Bianca stacks the soup cans in neat, long rows, tomato and vegetable and cream of mushroom, because canned soup is very popular with the families for some reason. She prefers the soups Tia Maria makes from scratch and simmers all day in an iron pot on the stove, full of herbs and vegetables and shellfish, whatever's fresh from the sea. But the families like their food bland, apparently. Bland and stale and rich, just like themselves. She crosses herself when she thinks this. The families are the island's lifeblood, after all, and Tio Manuelo makes all his profit in the summer from cans of soup and boxes of saltine crackers. But it's true. Except for young Mr. Fisher, of course. There's nothing bland or stale about him. She knows all about him. He lives in a rambling house not far from the village, all by itself overlooking Fleet Rock, and so new that, in certain corners shielded from the weather anyway, the cedar shingles haven't yet faded to gray. The family is not quite so distinguished as those who live at the other end of the island, the eastern end, where the Winthrop Island Club and its magnificent golf course stretch out over 100 precious green acres. The Fisher money is too new, Tio Manuelo says sagely over dinner, but give it time. Money ages with remarkable speed. Already Mr. Fisher has been to Harvard, where he became friends with the sons of all the correct families, such as Peter Dumont. There's even a rumor going about that Mr. Fisher became engaged over Easter to Peter's sister, Abigail. But Bianca refuses to believe this. For one thing, Abigail Dumont is 25, 3 years older than Mr. Fisher, and for another thing, she's tall and wide-shouldered and has no breasts, no feminine qualities at all, a loud, braying voice like a well-bred donkey. While the newspapers call Miss Dumont things like magnetic and incandescent, Bianca's certain that Mr. Fisher has better taste than that. He spends his mornings on the cliffs between the village and Greyfriars. Greyfriars is the name given to the new Fisher house, for what reason nobody can imagine, other than the color of the cedar shingles as they fade, spends his mornings, that is, with his watercolors and his books, so beautiful that Bianca sometimes cannot even breathe when she sees him there, legs swinging dangerously over the cliff's edge, his perfect brow compressed in concentration. She knows many other things. She knows his exact height, 5'11½", and the color of his eyes, as blue as the Mediterranean Sea, and his prowess at sailing, of course, but also at hockey, he was the team captain at Harvard, and at golf, at which he won the Winthrop Island Club Championship last summer, the first summer of the Fisher family's membership. The Dumonts sponsored them. Bianca knows this because her cousin Laura happened to be stepping out with one of the club caddies last year, at night and in secret, and he knew just about everything you ever wanted to know about the families, because they, for some reason, thought the caddies had no ears in their heads except to receive commands. Or maybe they thought a 10-cent tip was enough to buy the loyalty of an impecunious college boy. The families were cheap tippers. It was part of their ethic. Not so Mr. Fisher. He once gave her cousin Manuelo a whole dollar for helping him push his Buick Battistini Roadster back to Greyfriars from the village, where it broke down outside the ice cream parlor. How Bianca had envied Manuelo that magical day, as his manly shoulders strained side by side with Mr. Fisher's shoulders, even though the road ascended some 100 feet in total before it reached the summit on which Greyfriars was built, and the effort must have been enormous. When Manuelo returned, flushed and sweating, she had asked him what they talked about, and his face went carefully blank, and he said nothing. So she knew Mr. Fisher had confided some secret in Manuelo, and that made her doubly jealous. In fact, Bianca's thinking about that August afternoon right now, as she stacks her cans of soup in the hot, musty interior of the Medeiros' general store on Hemlock Street, right at the harbor's edge. She's remembering how Mr. Fisher took off his linen jacket and rolled up the sleeves of his shirt, and how strong his back seemed as he bent himself over the graceful rump of the Buick, how his shoulders formed the broad side of a damp, neat triangle that narrowed and then disappeared down the slim waistband of his trousers. She sets down another can of soup and crosses herself, and at that exact instant, by some arrangement of the universe, she hears none other than Hugh Fisher's young, enthusiastic, unmistakable voice calling out from the front of the store. The coincidence is so remarkable that at first she thinks she's imagined it.
"Hello?" he calls again. "Anybody there?"
Bianca waits behind the tall shelf while her heart pounds and pounds, not breathing, waiting for Tia Maria to reply, for one of her cousins to reply. But nobody does.
"Hello? Francisca? Anybody?"
He's going to leave. She lifts her hand to smooth her hair, but there's a can of soup stuck between her fingers, and she bumps her head with it instead. She shoves the soup on the shelf and darts out into the open, just as Mr. Fisher's turning to the open front door.
"Hello? Mr. Fisher?"
He swivels back, and all at once he's looking at her. Her. Bianca Madiero, and nobody else. And the whole world lights up under the color of his gaze, the wattage of his smile.
"Well, hello," he says. "I was hoping to buy a bottle or two of vinegar."
2. Another thing she knows about Hugh Fisher. Last summer, he fell in love with her cousin Francisca, the third and the oldest of Tia Maria and Tio Manuelo's children, who's engaged to marry Pascal Vargas in the autumn. Francisca, who was perfectly aware of Bianca's infatuation, tried to keep the affair secret for her sake. But Bianca knew almost from the first, when Francisca made some excuse about taking a walk one night last July, and came back flushed and bright-eyed an hour later, smelling of a particular kind of masculine soap that Tio Manuelo doesn't stock in his store. In truth, Bianca hadn't really minded. Francisca going to meet Hugh Fisher at night was almost as close as Bianca herself going to meet Hugh Fisher. And when she heard the back door open and squeakily close, she imagined Francisca running up the slope to the cliffs under the moonlight. Francisca embracing Hugh Fisher while the phosphorescent sea pounded beneath them, in a way she couldn't imagine Mr. Fisher embracing so distant an object as Miss Dumont. By touching Francisca's skin the next morning, Bianca felt she was somehow touching Mr. Fisher. And another thing. Last summer, Francisca was fully grown, 19 years old, lush and beautiful, and Bianca was only 16. Her period had just started the previous winter, and her face was round and spotty and childlike. As she lay throughout July and August in the little bedroom she shared with her cousins, listening to their clandestine comings and goings, she was happier imagining making love to Hugh Fisher as beautiful Francisca than she would have been to actually make love to him as herself. It was safer and infinitely more pleasant. Then came the end of summer, when the families all returned to their houses in New York and Boston and Providence and Philadelphia, including the Fishers. Francisca moped to devastating effect. She appeared at the dinner table, tear-stained and listless, eating nothing, and she completed her chores like one of those machines in a factory, without joy. When she accepted Pascal Vargas's proposal at Christmas, everybody thought she finally saw sense, because the color returned to her cheeks, and her hips reacquired their old sway, and she plunged herself into the assembling of her trousseau, the most elaborate and comprehensive trousseau in the history of the Madeiro women, because Pascal Vargas had made a great deal of money in his lobster boat during the past few years, a great deal. And now he has just received the appointment to keep the Fleet Rock Lighthouse come October. Francisca will live in luxury, almost. So what if her devoted husband-to-be is past 40 years old and resembles nothing so much as a leathery, dark-haired gnome? Who cares about romance when you've got a fiancé with money in the bank and a steady, respectable job? But Bianca's not so sure. Bianca hasn't missed the new brightness of her cousin's eyes now that the Fishers have returned to Winthrop Island. She hasn't missed the way Francisca makes excuses to go walking in the cliffs above the village, or offers to help her brother Manuelo make the rounds throughout the island in their father's old Model T delivery truck. And this summer is a whole new summer. Francisca's engaged. She's practically a matron, and Bianca has finally achieved that transformation of which young girls dream, from duckling into swan. Over the winter, her spots disappeared and her face became luminous and refined. Her hair grew in thick and her small, dainty body rounded out in all those places men admire. As Easter passed and the blossoms came out and the harsh New England air turned soft and warm, as she prepared to graduate from the tiny Winthrop Island school and turn free, Bianca felt her hour had struck. Her blood sang in her veins. She woke restless every morning. She felt that something grand beckoned around the corner, the future for which she was destined. All she needed was a sign. 3. Is this the sign? Hugh Fisher standing right there in the front of the store, a foot or two away from the wooden counter with the vinegar, not vinegar, hidden inside, wearing a blue seersucker suit that made his eyes even bluer than she remembered? Already his skin is golden with sunshine and pink with heat, and his shiny blonde hair reminds her of the helmet of Apollo. She will cross herself later. Bianca tucks a loose strand behind her ear. Tia Maria won't let them bob their hair. She absolutely refuses to let her girls turn fast like all the others. So Bianca arranges hers in a loose knot at the back of her head and then pulls out the dark curling locks at the sides so that the silhouette approximates that of Clara Bow. "What kind of vinegar do you need, sir?" she asks politely, though her heart knocks like crazy next to her lungs, making speech difficult. His smile turns sheepish.
"Well, now, I've heard you stock a special kind of vinegar here, and I'm all out. Fellow was supposed to make a delivery at the Greyfriars boathouse last night, and he never turned up."
Bianca glances anxiously at Tio Manuelo's sacred counter and back to Hugh Fisher's lips. She can't quite meet his gaze, not until her nerves stop jumping like this, not until she can keep her eyes from filling with tears at the perfection of his beauty, so close as to be within reach.
"I'm afraid I don't know much about vinegar," she says.
"No, of course not, a sweet young thing like you. Is your father here?"
"My uncle," she says, hot with shame. "A sweet young thing? Hasn't he seen she's a woman now, a swan? Hasn't he noticed her luminous skin and her shining hair, the glorious new curves to her breasts and her hips? All the boys are noticing her now, the men too, but she hasn't looked back at any of them, not one. This blossoming beauty of hers is meant for only one man in the world, and he stands before her now, and he won't look. He won't see."
"Your uncle, if he's in the back, I can find him."
"He's away."
"There's nobody else here? Just you?"
"Yes," Bianca says, though she's not quite sure on this point. "Laura and Tia Maria were both here a moment ago. Where have they gone? Into the back garden to sneak a cigarette or two?"
"I see."
He looks at her kindly, as if she's a simple child, as if she's nothing more than the sweet young thing he called her, and reaches into the inside pocket of his seersucker jacket.
Then perhaps you can give him my card. Here, I'll write my telephone number on the back. Can you give this to him for me?
He sticks the pencil stub back in his pocket and holds out the card with his strong, smooth fingers. Bianca reaches out and takes it, and when her fingertips inevitably brush against his fingertips, the sensation travels all the way up her arm and down her ribs and her stomach to her legs. She breathes in deeply to smell Mr. Fisher's particular shaving soap, which doesn't belong to any of the soap Tio Manuelo stocks on his shelves. The scent is like magic to her. She even wavers on her feet, so intoxicating is this flavor.
"Are you all right?"
Mr. Fisher asks, in a voice of true concern.
"Yes, I'm all right."
Fully drunk now, she opens her eyes, which were closed in appreciation of Mr. Fisher's soap, and this time she meets his gaze, his dazzling blue eyes, and she watches in triumph as they widen, like the flare of a match.
"I'm sorry," he says. "I don't believe I know your name."
"It's Bianca. Bianca Madero."
She tucks the card into the pocket of her pinafore apron.
"And I think I know where to find your vinegar, Mr. Fisher."
4. Hugh Fisher walks away with 2 bottles and an order for more, whatever Tio Manuelo's got, and Bianca promises to deliver this merchandise herself. "To the boathouse," he says. "There's a hatch door on the ceiling. You'll find it." Before he leaves, he takes her hand and kisses it, first on the back and then, turning it reverently over, in the middle of her palm. He curls her fist to trap the kiss inside, and he says in a voice of deep sincerity,
"It's been a pleasure, Miss Madero. Until we meet again?"
"Yes," she answers breathlessly,
and for the rest of the day, at least 6 inches of air exist between Bianca's feet and the ground beneath them. When she settles into bed that night, she cannot sleep. She presses her palm to her lips. She hasn't washed that blessed hand. Of course not. And thinks, at last, it's the sign that my life has truly begun. This time, she does not cross herself. 1951. Miranda Schuyler. 1. On the morning of my mother's wedding, I watched a pair of lobster boats crawl across the sea outside my bedroom window, setting their pots while the sun rose. They were some distance apart, one to the east of the Flood Rock Lighthouse and one to the west, and I wouldn't have known they were lobstermen. I knew nothing about fishing in those days, except that I had a pair of binoculars, and I saw them dropping the pots one by one from the sterns of their boats. Each pot was attached to a rope, and at the end of the rope was a colored buoy that bobbed cheerfully in the water as the vessel pulled away. Behind me, my mother stirred.
"Is that you, Miranda?"
she asked, in a slurred, sleepy voice.
"Yes."
"What time is it?"
"Only 5:30. Go back to sleep, Mama."
"What?"
mumbling. "So early."
"Watching the lobster boats?" She sighed and grunted, the way you do when you're still half asleep, and you settle yourself gratefully back on a pillow and close your eyes.
"Strange girl, Miranda,"
she muttered. I wondered if she remembered she was getting married today. Sometimes when you sleep deeply enough, you forget everything you ever knew, even your own name, and Winthrop Island is possibly the quietest place in the world at night, except for the pulse of the ocean, so black and velvet that sleep comes as easy as that, as closing your eyes. You fall and fall like an anchor that finds no bottom, and I don't believe I have ever again slept as I slept throughout that summer of 1951, in my bedroom at my stepfather's sprawling house on the island. Except on that morning at the beginning of June, the morning of Mama's wedding. Hugh Fisher wasn't quite my stepfather. The fateful summer still lay before me, a reel of film waiting to unspool, and how could I know that I was right now witnessing its first momentous scene? I mean, You never do suspect what inconsequential event will change the course of your life. This particular morning, I only thought about the wedding to come. That was the affair of the day, wasn't it? The great occasion. Instead of sleeping deeply, I'd woken at dawn after a restless night, and now I knelt by the window, holding the binoculars to my eyes as the lobstermen labored on the water, and the sun climbed drowsily above the ocean. I watched the lighthouse change color, from violet to palest pink to gold, and the surrounding rocks emerge from shadow, and the little buoys multiply in long bobbing lines behind the boats. I watched the lobstermen shift about. In the easternmost boat, there were two of them, one short and broad-shouldered, wearing a striped shirt and a knitted cap, the other taller and leaner and bareheaded, hauling the wooden cages into the water while his shipmate baited them. In the second boat, the one to the west, there was only one old man. He moved slowly, dropping maybe one trap for every three from the other boat, and as the light grew, I saw the bulge of his tattooed arms, the silvery beard that grizzled around his face. He was nearly bald and chewed a pipe, and in my head I named him Popeye. I thought there was something awful and tragic about the way he baited each pot, attached line and buoy, and dragged it over the edge of the boat. Or maybe I only endowed him with those qualities in retrospect. Memory's funny that way. At any rate, the eastern boat ran out of pots or something, because it turned around and started back for the harbor, disappearing behind the Flood Rock lighthouse for an instant or two, and then reappearing, its white sides brilliant in the glare of the sun. At the same time, the boat flashed back into view. Popeye was swinging another lobster pot over the side of his boat, and maybe a wave jogged him, or maybe he lost his footing, I don't know. I'd returned my gaze to the other boat by then, and the lithe, bareheaded, carefree man who now stood at the wheel, a young man, arms and face richly tanned, curled hair whipping in the draft. So I never knew why Popeye went flying into the sea. I just saw the young man jolt, saw him turn his head and yell at his shipmate, saw him bend and yank off his rubber boots, and the next thing I knew he was diving into the water in a long, clean arc. Now, I've heard many times that most fishermen don't know how to swim, as a matter of superstition or something. If that's true, this particular fisherman wasn't the superstitious kind. 100 yards is a long way to swim, especially in the cold northern waters of early June, but he swam them just like he was stroking laps in the YMCA pool, regular and sure of arm, minding not the distance or the chill or the chop of waves. As I knelt there on the floorboards of my bedroom, frozen tight, following his progress through the glass of the binoculars, he made a final surge and dove under the surface, right where Popeye had just ceased to flail and resigned himself to sinking, and I thought, God save us, how is such a skinny fellow going to drag a stocky, solid artifact like Popeye back to fresh air? I held my own breath in solidarity with the two of them. My arms began to shake, so I leaned forward and steadied my elbows on the window frame, keeping that patch of water in view, counting the giant thuds of my heart. When I reached too many, I abandoned numbers and started to whimper. Please, please, please. That carefree boy, that poor old man. Please, Lord, please. I still remember the silent glitter of the sun on that water. The particular musty, salty linen smell of that bedroom, newly aired after the winter hibernation. A smell that still recalls the terror of that moment to my mind. And sometimes I think, well, what if they'd never come up again? What if he'd never come up again? What if those two lobstermen had drowned together on the morning of my mother's wedding, young and old, a terrible tragedy overclouding a day of promise, and I never knew either of them? I guess there's no answer to that question. Because just as I started to panic, to lower the binoculars and rise from my knees and shout for help, they exploded together through the glittering waves like a single breaching whale. The younger man lunged for a rope hanging off near the stern of Popeye's boat, hauled Popeye over the side, hauled himself. thwacked Popeye a good one right on the back so Popeye vomited up a few gallons of cold salt water. Then he grabbed the wheel of the boat with his left hand and the throttle with his right hand, and he made not for the harbor, a mile away on the sheltered side of the island, but for the nearest dock, Hugh Fisher's dock, my almost stepfather's dock, the dock directly in line from my bedroom window. Boy, did I rise then. I jumped straight up and ran for the door, ran down the stairs, ran to the kitchen, shouted at the kitchen maid to call the doctor, boat coming in, a man near drowned, a lobsterman. Her pink face went round with amazement. "Who?" she cried. "Some old fellow out by himself." "Golly, that'll be Mr. Silva." She spun for the telephone hanging on the wall, and I threw open the kitchen door and ran down the soft green lawn, past the swimming pool, past the big white tents awaiting the wedding, past the boathouse, and down the wooden dock where the breeze blew on my cheeks and the sun drenched me, and the drone of the lobster boat's engine filled my ears like the sound of 1,000 approaching honeybees. 2. My father named me Miranda. He was a teacher at a pure-blood girls' boarding school in Virginia. Not an English teacher, as you might expect from a name like that, but an art teacher. Painting mostly, although he also taught sculpture, as the traffic allowed. Still, he loved books, especially old ones. He taught me to read when I was very small, 2 or 3 years old, and by the time I was 5 we were decanting Shakespeare aloud to each other, each of us taking parts. We sat in his study, a fusty, tiny, comfortable room with large windows. I took the leather Chesterfield sofa while he filled the armchair nearby. We drank cocoa and the air smelled of chocolate and leather, and especially books. You know the smell I mean. I don't know if it's the ink or the paper or the glue in the bindings, but it's a very particular odor. I still smell it, somewhere in my memory, and it carries me back to that room and the sound of my father's voice as he began John of Gaunt's dying speech.
"Methinks I am a prophet new inspired, and thus expiring do foretell of him."
He had a beautiful, round baritone, and as he sat there in his armchair and spoke, one leg crossed over the other, wearing his soft shirt and tweed jacket and woolen vest, while his blue eyes fixed not on the page, he knew the words, but upon, or rather through, the opposite wall of the study, I might have thought he really was the Duke of Lancaster, the great Plantagenet prince, splendid in his despair. To my mind, there was no man more heroic than my father.
"This land of such dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputation throughout the world, is now leased out. I die pronouncing it," here his voice shook with agony, "like to a tenement or pelting farm, England, bound in with the triumphant sea whose rocky shore beats back the envious siege of watery Neptune, is now bound in with shame."
And he named me Miranda, Prospero's daughter, raised alone by her magician father on an uncharted island of fairies and strange creatures. I used to wonder why he chose that particular character, that particular daughter, that particular play. I think it had something to do with the sea, which he always loved, and with tempests, which also fascinated him. There may be more than that, but I'll never know. He embarked for England, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this precious stone set in the silver sea, on the 2nd day of November, 1943, when I was 10 years old, and I last glimpsed him waving at the rail of a gray-painted troopship before it dissolved like a ghost into the dark mist of New York Harbor. That was all. Still, I don't think I've ever forgiven the sea for swallowing up my father like that. As I stood there at the end of the Greyfriars dock, watching the lobster boat tear toward me, the drone of its engine filled me with an unnameable thrill. Terror or joy, I couldn't tell. It just seemed to me that watery Neptune, having swallowed my father, was now spitting something back 8 years later.
something in the shape of a stripling boy with dark, curling hair and tanned skin who could rescue a man from drowning. 3. Now, I didn't know much about boats in those days, but I knew enough to grab the rope the young man tossed me and loop it tight around one of the bollards. The tide was high and slack, and the boat rode only a foot or two beneath the wooden planks. Inside the boat lay Popeye, coughing and wheezing, bleeding all over the place from I don't know where. The young man lifted Popeye in his arms and hoisted him up toward the dock, where I hooked my arms around his shoulders and dragged him away from the edge. He was heavier than I thought, made of wet, compact bone and muscle, and my bare feet slipped against the wood. "Careful!" exclaimed the young man, leaping up beside me, and he tore open Popeye's shirt and checked his heart, his breath, because he'd stopped wheezing and now lay limp in my arms. "The doctor's on his way," I gasped out. "I saw you from the window."
"Ah, Jesus, Mary, his arm."
I looked at Popeye's left arm, which was bent horribly, leaking blood.
"Here," said the youth, "hold it steady while I lift him. Can you do that? 1, 2, 3.
I scrambled to my feet and bent to cradle Popeye's elbow while the young man scooped him carefully upward, lifting that weathered old fellow like, I don't know, like a knight would lift a damsel. Now I could see the bone sticking through the skin, through the wet plaid shirt, but I wasn't going to be sick, oh no. I thought the nurses in the war saw far worse, didn't they? Some nurse maybe tended my father. They hadn't flinched, and neither would I. I laid Popeye's arm across his middle as best I could, and we started down the dock to the lawn. Popeye remained still. I prayed he wasn't dead. The sun hit the side of my face as we loped up the slope of the lawn, past the boathouse and the tents, up the steps of the terrace and around back to the kitchen, where the maid was waiting for us.
"Put him right here, Joseph. I cleared the kitchen table. Doctor will be a minute. Oh, Jesus, Mary," she cried. "Look at him. What happened?"
Down he went on the table. Joseph checked his chest again and swore, bent over his face and pinched his nose and laid his mouth on Popeye's mouth, breathed the air of his own lungs into Popeye's lungs while the maid ran for kitchen towels or something. I just stood there, holding Popeye's arm together, not knowing what else to do. After a breath or two, Popeye started to heave, and Joseph rolled him quick on his side. Out came another quart or so of water, more sputtering, a groan of misery, and the doctor burst through the door right that second, dressing gown flapping around his legs, thank God. 4. There has never been any such thing as a hospital on Winthrop Island, as I later learned. Either you were sick enough to head for the hospital on the mainland, or you made do in your bed at home. This doctor, Dr. Huxley, didn't have a regular practice here. He was a summer resident who made himself available for emergencies on the understanding that he wasn't to be disturbed during cocktail hour or golf. Lucky for Popeye, the good doctor was an early riser who just happened to live half a mile up Winthrop Road from Greyfriars. He set Popeye's broken arm and stitched up the holes in his hide, and Mr. Fisher had him put up in one of the guest bedrooms with strict instructions to watch for signs of pneumonia. "What about his family?" I said. "Shouldn't we telephone them or something?" Joseph looked down at me kindly.
"He hasn't got any family. Wife died 2 years ago. Kids moved to the mainland."
"Oh, that's a shame."
"That's the way it is on the island, I guess. Kids move away."
He was blushing a little, looking down at me, and I realized I still wore my old green flannel nightgown, which was wet with seawater and blood and stuck to my skin. I crossed my arms over my chest. Mr. Fisher and Dr. Huxley were upstairs with the maid, settling the patient in some spare bedroom or other. The kitchen was growing warm as the sun penetrated the window glass, and I noticed the smell of something baking, something sugary and vanilla-scented, something for the wedding. So I supposed the oven was on, too, adding to the general heat. I stared at the kitchen table, which Joseph had helped me clean up just now, dishcloths and hot water and vinegar that still stained the air. All immaculate. Erased. You'd never know what happened. Just any old big kitchen on any old big summer estate. Two people standing in awkward proximity like a pair of actors who've lost their place in the script. Joseph started to turn away toward the door. "Want some coffee?" I said.
"Have you got any made? I mean, you needn't make fresh."
"I think so."
I went to the electric percolator on the counter and lifted it. Heavy. Behind me, there was a faint scrape of a chair leg on the linoleum. I opened up a few cabinets, looking for coffee cups. Joseph cleared his throat.
"You must be the daughter, then. Mrs. Schuyler's daughter."
"Yes, I am."
"Well, I'm sure sorry I ruined the big day for you."
"Oh, gosh, that's nothing. I mean, he's alive, isn't he? That's got to be good luck. Thanks to you. The day's not ruined at all. Do you want cream or anything?"
"I'll get it."
The chair scraped again, and from the corner of my eye I saw him step to the icebox and open the door. He stood about an inch under 6 feet, and he still wore his yellow oilskin overalls atop his wet shirt, though his hair was beginning to dry in soft little waves around his ears. I turned toward him and offered the coffee cup.
"Thanks,"
he said, dribbling a bit of cream from a small blue pitcher.
"You?"
"Yes, please."
He moved the pitcher over my cup and tilted it so the narrowest possible rope of yellow-white cream fell inside.
"Say when."
"When?"
He moved away, putting the cream back in the icebox, and I turned to the window so he wouldn't catch me looking at the place where his hair met the back of his neck. I didn't know much about boys. I'd hardly spent any time around a boy, and I couldn't tell how old he was. 20? 21? Older than me, for certain. Though his skin was fresh and unlined, there was something fully grown about his shoulders, something wide and weight-bearing. And his voice had an easy, mature timbre, not like a boy's voice at all. Older than me. Maybe not all that much, but enough. Not a boy, after all, but a grown-up, a man who worked for his bread, whereas I was still a child, only just graduated from school, 18 last February, 18 going on 8, as unworldly as a kitten in a basket. I stirred my coffee and sucked the spoon. Joseph came up next to me, not too close, and said,
"How do you like the island? You came up the other night, didn't you?"
"Oh, it's beautiful."
I set the spoon on the saucer. "How did you know? When I came up, I mean."
"Miss Schuyler, here's the first thing you need to know about the island. Everyone knows each other's business. All of it. About 5 minutes after it happens, if not sooner. Spreads through the air or something."
He paused to sip his coffee.
"Also, I saw Isabel driving you back from the ferry."
"Oh, of course."
The window overlooked the lawn and the tents. Sometime during the fuss of the past hour, an old rust-red Ford truck had driven onto the grass, and a couple of men were now unloading crates from the back. Crystal and china, I guessed. I could just see the edge of the dock and the tip of Popeye's boat tethered up on the other side against the pale blue sky.
"It's got the whole island buzzing," Joseph said.
"What has?"
"Why, the wedding. Mr. Fisher's a big man around here."
I shifted my feet and looked down at the still, muddy surface of my coffee. "I don't really know him that well. He's been awfully nice to Mama."
"I hear they met at your school, your mother and Mr. Fisher."
"Yes, last year."
I paused, and the silence seemed so heavy and almost rude, given the tender, friendly way he'd asked the question. I rushed on.
"At Isabel's graduation? One of the events. I don't really know which one. There's so many of them. Ceremonies and parties and things. My mother was a secretary in the president's office, you see, ever since my father... well, since my father..."
I stuttered to a stop, brought up short in the middle of all that flustered babbling by the thought of my father.
"Killed in the war, wasn't he?"
Joseph said without embarrassment.
"Why, how did you know?"
"Like I said, the island's been talking about this for weeks, Miss Schuyler. Not that I listen to gossip much, but you can't help hearing a few things, even without trying. My grandmother, she runs the general store in town. There's nothing she doesn't know.
I glanced at him, and though he stared straight ahead, holding the cup to his lips like he was fascinated by the unloading of crystal and china, I thought he was smiling a little.
"Is that so?" I said. "What else have you heard?"
"Oh, just this and that."
"You know, it's a funny thing. I didn't know this boy, this man, just his name and face and approximate age, and the fact that he trapped lobsters for a living, that he could swim, that he was the kind of fellow who would jump in the sea to save another fellow from drowning. He was a stranger, but he wasn't. We'd held a bleeding, broken man between the two of us. We'd watched the eternity of life pass before us. Now we shared a pot of coffee, stared out the same window, breathed the same air. So he wasn't a stranger. But he was." I set down my cup and turned around to hop up and sit on the counter. The clock on the opposite wall pointed its sharp black hands to 7:15. 7:15? I thought I'd lived a lifetime. I crossed my arms over my disgraceful nightgown and said, not to Joseph, but to the room at large, "He taught at Foxcroft for 11 years, my father. He took a leave of absence to join up, so when he was killed, Miss Charlotte gave Mama a job to make ends meet. She's like that, Miss Charlotte. Sort of tough and horsey, if you know what I mean, but heart of gold."
"What did he teach?"
"Art. That's why he volunteered, because he heard about what the Nazis were doing, looting and destroying all those treasures, and he couldn't stand by," he said.
"A good man, then."
"He was. Oh, he was. Of course, I was only 11 years old when he died, so maybe I never saw him as a real person, as somebody ordinary and fallen."
"No," Joseph said, "he fought for something he believed in. That's a hero in anyone's book."
"Everybody fought. Mr. Fisher fought."
"Yes, he did. Lucky for your mother, he got out alive, though."
"Yes, lucky for her."
"They say she's a real beauty, your mother."
"Mama? Oh, yes. Haven't you seen her?"
"Not up close, no. Just the photograph in the local rag."
"Sometimes I just stare at her, you know, thinking it's not possible anyone could be that beautiful. She was so young when she married Daddy, only just 18. Can you imagine being a widow at 29? But she loved him so much, she just couldn't look at anyone else for ever so long." He moved a little, turning his head to look at me.
"What about you? Happy about all this?"
"Me? Of course I am. Why shouldn't I be?"
"No reason."
"Mama's happy. The happiest I've ever seen her, at least since Daddy died. You can't mourn forever, can you?"
"That's true."
"And I guess Mr. Fisher loves her back, because he's not marrying her for money, that's for certain."
"A real Cinderella story, then."
He finished his coffee and moved to the sink, rinsed out his cup.
"Best be off. Gotta take Silva's tub back to the harbor, and Pops will be wondering where I am."
"Can't you signal him in or something? There's plenty of coffee left." He smiled.
"Pops had never come in here. Not Greyfriars."
"Really? Why not? Mr. Fisher's not some kind of snob, is he?"
"A snob? No, nothing like that. I'll say this about the island. The families and the locals, they respect each other, which is more than you can say of a lot of places like this."
"The families?"
"Some are residents, like you."
He wiped his fingers on a dish towel and held his hand out to me.
"Real nice to meet you, Miss Schuyler. Wish it could have been under friendlier circumstances, of course, but it's been a pleasure all the same."
I slid down from the counter and shook his hand. "It's Miranda."
"Miranda."
He smiled again.
"Admired Miranda. Indeed, the top of admiration. Worth what's dearest to the world."
I snatched at the edge of the counter behind me. I think my mouth made an amazed circle. Outside the window, which was cracked open an inch or two, the birds sang like mad, thrilled to pieces at the beauty of the morning, and Joseph just stared at me like we were sharing a secret, and he was waiting for me to find out what it was. Finally, I said, "Why, how do you know?" Joseph, my goodness, what's going on?
We turned to the doorway, where Isabel Fisher stood, long-limbed and done up in curlers, her yellow dressing gown belted at the waist. 5. I met Isabel Fisher at the same instant I stepped onto Winthrop Island for the first time, 2 nights before the wedding. The morning storms had